Hello, I'm Richard Deschamps. This is number 0247, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0247. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Mark Moyes, the author of the interactive mobile device children's book, Loose Strands.
Loose Strands is about a little boy, and he's grown up in a barber shop. They're very poor, so they use hair for almost everything, because it's the one thing that they have a lot of. So they wear hair clothes, they sleep in hair hammocks. You know, after they shower, they dry themselves off with hair towels. But the little twist on it is that by the time you get to the end of the first chapter, you realize that Roland has actually never been outside. He's not allowed to go outside. So he's grown up his whole life in this barber shop, and the story really begins when he does go outside.
We have another retro interview with a celebrity who recently passed away. This time around, a 2003 interview with Hollywood actor Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. He was always very appreciative of his fans.
I'm so grateful to them for their kindness and their support and their interest. And it's what you hope when you play, whether it's a series or a movie or whatever it is, you hope that it's giving people something that may enrich their lives a little bit. And when you learn that it has, it's very, very gratifying. I feel that that's the most gratifying thing about my work.
And Stuart Nolman is in with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nolman, and Book Banter salutes the great maternal figures of the silver screen with Mom in the Movies. So before you shout out, made it, Ma, top of the world, check out my review on the Stuff File program.
Plus, there's lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0247, was Richard Deschamps, who is a news anchor at CJAD Radio in Montreal. That's 800 on your AM dial, boys and girls. You can also check out their website at cjad.com. And thank you very much, Richard, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Three women in, appropriately enough, Beaverton, Oregon, were arrested after twerking at an impromptu dance party in the Beaverton City Hall parking lot. Police say one woman went to municipal court with two friends to pay a fine. The show began as they headed to the parking lot. Police say they exposed themselves as one of the women was filming their moves. One lifted her skirt and urinated between two cars. They also were accused of bringing drugs to the courthouse. Police stopped their car as they were driving away and arrested two 20-year-old Vancouver, Washington women and a 22-year-old from Portland, Oregon. So, there you go. Yes, talk about classy. I think, you know, that Sir John Gielgud said it best as Hobson in the movie Arthur.
Thank you for a memorable afternoon. Usually one must go to a bowling alley to meet a woman of your stature.
Yes. Meanwhile, elsewhere, sometimes people die for a reason. Maybe they're a soldier, or maybe they overdose on drugs. Some people just get sick and die for no reason at all. Then there are those people who get run over while doing push-ups, naked, in the street. The unfortunate fitness enthusiast was 43-year-old James Earl Hunter of Oregon. Portland police were called to report a man running naked into traffic at 4 a.m. As officers responded, a second report came in that the naked man was doing push-ups in the street. Then a third report that he'd been struck by a vehicle. Officers and emergency medical workers found the man deceased. The driver of the vehicle that struck the man remained at the scene and was cooperative. The driver was not impaired by alcohol or drugs, according to police. Yes, another classic Darwin file story. Because as you know, the tree of life is often self-pruning. And at least he was a really, really fit guy right up until the very end. Well, it seems Jedi mind tricks couldn't save a Vancouver woman wearing a Darth Vader mask from being arrested after an early morning robbery. She was wearing the Star Wars mask when she was arrested after the heist, according to the Vancouver Police spokesperson, Sergeant Randy Fincham. Unfortunately for this robber, she underestimated the power of the Force, said Fincham. Oh, good quote. Around 6:30 a.m., a 23-year-old woman was walking down Wolf Avenue when a woman wearing a Darth Vader mask was carrying a handgun and robbed her. The masked robber pointed the gun at the woman and demanded her cash. After securing a small amount of money, the suspect ran off and the victim was not injured. After a call to 911, the police launched a search for the suspect and found her a short distance away. She was still wearing the Darth Vader mask. The suspect, a 20-year-old Vancouver woman, was arrested without incident and found to be in possession of a fake gun. She was charged with robbery with a firearm and weapons offenses. So, there you go. Powerful, you have become. The dark side I sense in you. Stupidity, I also sense. Yes. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, an unnamed and rather embarrassed man from Bartow, Florida, was out on the town trying to find a lady friend to mate with when he came home all by himself, all on his own. The man said he was, quote-unquote, extremely horny. That's when he grabbed an empty can of beer and began to try to make love to it. Yeah, you see where this is going, huh? It was about two pumps in that he felt water dripping off his private area, and he looked down to find that it was indeed blood. The injury occurred when the 23-year-old twisted the can ever so slightly and split the skin, still humping whilst doing so, I may add. The man's penis was cut to ribbons, according to authorities, and will need surgery. The hospital expects that he will make a full recovery within a few weeks. Well, perhaps a full physical recovery, but I believe his mental state has a long way to go. Anyway, let's get to our first guest on the Stuff File program, shall we? Mark Moyes has brought the children's book into the 21st century. He's the author of Loose Strands, an interactive adventure novel designed for the iPad and Android tablets. Mark is on the line with us right now from Toronto to talk about his new novel. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Peter.
Thanks for being on the program with us.
Thank you.
The fact that you've written an interactive children's book, how much more difficult is that in the writing process, since there are, I would assume, many variables?
Yeah, it can be certainly more difficult. So by interactive, it there's a couple different things that are going on. There's some animation, and there's some, you know, so visually there's some things that normally a writer doesn't have to deal with. But it's also sort of like a choose your own adventure. So you have to sort of plot out all these different alternative plot lines, right? Now, it's actually a little bit more complicated than that because of the way that we did it, which is, so you have to imagine, so you take a book and a book has, you know, whatever, all these pages sequentially. And the way that we worked out the interactivity, the choosing part, is that we took all the pages of the book, basically, and laid them out almost as if you were playing a game of memory with cards. So you lay out sort of 10 cards in a row, and then another row, and then another row. So it creates this almost grid. And what's a little bit different about Loose Strands is, instead of just going, you know, left to right, every once in a while you get a choice, and you can go down, or you can go, you know, back left, or you can go up. It ended up being actually enormously difficult to plot this all out, because you're basically creating a maze, and you had to make sure all the pieces connected and all that stuff. So that actual part of it, I had no idea how long that was going to take, but it took almost a month just to do that part and make sure that everything, you know, matches up together and all the strands connect in the right way.
Now, did you have to do a sort of a dry run with kids? Because no matter how much you plot things out and you want to do things in a certain way, kids have their own way of thinking that kind of undermines all of the adults.
Yeah, well, we did. We definitely showed it to kids. The thing that I actually found with technology, sometimes the people that you want to test on are the older people, because they were the ones who sort of, you know, weren't necessarily as familiar with, you know, swiping things on a screen and like, and things like that. So the kids didn't really have a big problem with it. They picked it up pretty quickly. But sometimes when we were showing it to people who were my age or older, in the initial versions, they were like, I don't really, you know, they were trying to swipe from off the side of the iPad, and that wasn't working in one of the versions. And so we fixed a bunch of those types of things.
Okay. So tell us what the story of Loose Strands is all about.
Sure. So Loose Strands is about a little boy whose name is Roland Bartholomew Dester III. And he's grown up in a barbershop, and his family's very poor. They only have one customer. It's a mean old man named Mr. Puddlewick. They're very poor, so they use hair for almost everything, because it's the one thing that they have a lot of. So they wear hair clothes. They sleep in hair hammocks. You know, after they shower, they dry themselves off with hair towels. And so that's, you know, there's a hair motif that goes through the whole book. But the little twist on it is that by the time you get to the end of the first chapter, you realize that Roland has actually never been outside. He's not allowed to go outside. So he's grown up his whole life in this barbershop. And the story really begins when he does go outside. He makes a choice to go outside. And he partially prompted by a young girl who appears at his sort of painted over window, right? There's a noise outside, and they start then exploring and finding out why he hasn't been allowed to go outside.
This book is written for what age group exactly?
So we're targeting 9 and up. I mean, kids all have different, you know, reading levels and whatever, but that's sort of what we're saying. I think there are probably some 8-year-olds who like it and some, you know, older people who like it too.
Now, in your day life, you also work as a web developer. Was it always the idea when you were deciding to write this book that it was going to be interactive, or did that come along after?
I was actually working on a different children's book first. And so I have a writing background. I actually worked in magazines for a really long time as an editor. But I've always had this like dual thing. So, you know, when I went to U of T, I got a major in English and a major in computer science. So I've always been doing both. So I was working on a different children's novel. And then I started to see how kids were interacting with the iPad. And, you know, I got really excited about it. And so that's when I sort of built this story around, you know, the interactivity.
So someone like yourself who is creative, you say you got your hands on an iPad and you got excited about it. Does just the technology itself fuel your creative juices?
Oh, for sure. I mean, there was and is an explosion of creativity from all sorts of indie developers and whatever. Just because, you know, you've... Well, I actually, you know, to be honest, you know, years ago I had all these ideas for adding music to stories that I was writing and adding interactive elements. But it's just not as nice on the computer screen, right? Like, you don't want to read a book in front of a computer screen. So the iPad really, I mean, it was, yeah, for sure, totally, very inspiring.
So what you're saying is you were ahead of your time.
Well, yes, of course. That's what I want everyone to believe. Yeah.
How do one, since it is an interactive book, how does one actually get their hands on Loose Strands?
It's available. So if you have an iPad, you can get it in the App Store. It's also on, sorry, I keep saying iPad. It's also on Android tablets. So if you have, you know, those Samsung tablets, Google Nexus, all of those. And the Amazon Kindle Fire. So you can get it on Google Play. Or you can get it on Amazon, but only if you have an Amazon tablet, right? Not a regular Kindle e-reader, because of the animation and the programming involved, it doesn't run on a regular e-book.
And by the way, I had a chance to take a look at the trailer, which is at darnsock.com/loose-strands, and the link is up on our website. But I had a chance to take a look at that trailer, and it really is a fun-looking book.
Yeah, the illustrator, Jeff, who actually happens to be my cousin, I was working with trying to work with a bunch of different people and I sort of stumbled across my own cousin, which was amazing. But he's so talented and people really respond to his illustrations. So that's great.
Well, it's always good to keep it in the family.
Yeah, that's right.
I guess it's called Loose Strands because that Broadway musical already has the other title, right?
Yeah. Well, it's also, so this is the other one thing that I'll sort of say, because the story is about choice. And so one of the unique things about Loose Strands is whenever you make a choice, you actually see the pages disappear. So every choice that you make has consequences which pop up, and you can sort of see all the pages disappear that, as a result of your choice. And so that was the idea of these narrative strands that sort of that are loose and fall out, right? Like strands of hair.
Have you had fun with kids who are reading this book, if they get to read it a second and third time and make different choices?
Well, one of the things is that it's important that people know that this is actually a novel, right? It's not a lot of the books that are out now for kids, these types of books, and these are really great ones, but they tend to be shorter. And so I would love to sit down with a child and read the whole book and watch them read the whole book from beginning to end and see all the choices they make and whatever. But you know, it's Harry Potter size, so it's going to take a reasonable amount of time. I mean, there's a lot of time just on your first read through, so there's a lot of sort of, you know, value there. But I haven't actually been able to sit down with someone and watch them go through and watch them do the second time around. But I would love to hear about it. So if if anybody does that, please send me a note and let me know your experiences.
The book is called Loose Strands, written by Mark Moyes. And Mark, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Yeah, thank you.
Mark Moyes, author of Loose Strands. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0247, and you'll find links to Mark's website and also links to the Amazon App Store where you can order his book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's The Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick. If you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
This is The Stuff File.
It's time for another retro interview with a celebrity that is no longer with us. This time around, it's a chat I had back in July of 2003, and it's a well-respected actor who just recently passed away. We're talking about Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. He was best known for his roles in two long-running television shows on ABC. First, 77 Sunset Strip, which aired from 1958 until 1964. Then he was the star of The FBI from 65 to 74. When we caught up with him in 2003, he was still a very busy actor, and he was also promoting his new book entitled My Dinner of Herbs. Here now is a part of that conversation.
You had quite a long run, as I mentioned, on ABC. Your first series, which was 77 Sunset Strip, went for what, 7 years?
6 years.
Six years.
It went for 5 years, and then Jack Warner got in a fit of temper and fired the whole studio, practically. Fired the whole television department, fired all the actors under contract, let the contracts lapse, and I was the only actor left under contract. There had been 50-odd. And he changed, at that point, the format of 77, which had been on 4 years, and it just changed it completely and brought in Jack Webb as a producer of television and Bill Conrad as our producer. And we started out on a whole new tack, and I mean, totally different show from the old one. Not a bad show, but not at all the show that had been on before and that people had come to enjoy. So it came as a terrible shock, I think, to the audience. It was a miscalculation of the first order.
Yeah, because for those who remember the show originally, the title of the show, 77 Sunset Strip, basically dealt with what, the detective agency that...
Yeah.
That you guys worked at, and there was Ed Kookie Barnes in the parking lot, at least.
That's right.
For the first year, and then he became one of your partners.
That's right.
And I think that's what people remember most about the show. And then the last year that it was on, as you said, it was just you.
Yeah.
Or you and a new cast members, and your role kind of changed. You were traveling the world, and there's a little bit of espionage involved, and...
What I became was a carbon copy of Jack Webb in Gunsmoke,
Dragnet.
Dragnet.
Right.
Even to the same clothes. I talked like him, and it was a copy of Jack Webb, and it was a bad copy.
Mm-hmm.
And my part in that year that we were on was terrible. I think I was awful, but there were some very good shows, nonetheless.
Now, when all the changes were made, and you were the only one to survive all those changes, did you kind of look around and go, "Why am I here? And can I get out, or do I just ride this one through?"
Well, there was nothing I could do. You know, I was under contract, and when you were under contract to the studios in those days, you either. You know, if you wanted to get out, you went to court, and you sued them and hoped you'd win and so forth. But other than that, which I never had any desire to do, you just had to do what they told you to do. And so I just did this show. I figured, well, they must know something. So I went ahead, but it only lasted 1 year.
I'm sure from that music sounds very familiar to you.
You know, I haven't heard that in such a long time.
Theme song to the television show The FBI. And I remember when I was a kid watching that show, I always used to look forward to the beginning of the brand new season because I'm a big fan of television. I always want to know what kind of little changes television shows did when a new season started. But with The FBI, the thing I wanted to know is, would you be coming out of that big building and would you be getting into a brand new Ford?
Oh, you know that we used to go back to Washington every May, and I went back with a skeleton crew, and we'd shoot just drive-ins and drive-outs all around Washington in the new Ford, which wouldn't be out until October.
Right.
So they put together a thing which they shipped down to Washington, and just for this purpose, and they kept it under wraps in a huge truck and until the moment when I had to get into it and drive. And it was, when I got in, it was a total wreck. I mean, there was nothing inside. There was no dashboard. There was no upholstery. There was nothing. It was just a shell. But on the outside, it looked like the model that would be out in October. And if you slammed the door, it would fall off. I mean, it was just stuck together with spirit gum and scotch tape. So I'd drive it around Washington and so forth. And then after 2 or 3 days, they'd put it back in the truck and ship it to Dearborn, where it would be cubed and destroyed, and that would be the end of its life.
So the only person that got to drive this car basically was you.
And that was the only thing that was new every year, was the car and the clothes.
Right. Now, what was also unique about the show, I guess, it had a very strong connection with Ford,
yeah,
the automaker.
And, well, all of the Warner shows had.
And it had a very strong connection with the FBI itself.
Yes, it did.
Is it true that J. Edgar Hoover actually had to approve your casting in the role?
Oh, yeah, there's no doubt about it. Well, you see, for Hoover, it represented a sort of a training film for the FBI. He felt that the FBI was on display, and so he wanted to, what happened was he had turned down, I think, 600 applications for series, and then he allowed Warner Brothers to make a movie that Mervyn LeRoy directed with Jimmy Stewart called The FBI Story. And he liked it so much that they won him over, and he agreed to let them do a series. And that was the sort of genesis of the whole thing. I had finished 77 about a year and a half before this, and I really was tired of being in a series, and I was glad to be out. But in that year and a half, I wasn't very happy with the properties that came my way. I did a couple of good movies and some good television specials. But on the whole, I felt that it was not a very promising period. And so I called my agent and I said, you know, if you could get me a good series, I'd like to go back into it. And he said, well, Warner Brothers has got this series called The FBI, and they've called Quinn Martin to produce it, and let me call him. Well, an hour later, we had a deal, and that was how it all happened.
Did you actually meet with J. Edgar Hoover?
Oh, I not only met with him, I met with him every year when we went back to Washington to do these drive-ins. I had a meeting with him, and we became good friends in the sense that I didn't see him on a regular basis, but I knew him quite well, and he wrote to me many, many letters. I have, you know, maybe 50 or 100 letters that he wrote me, brief but friendly, and he liked the show. He liked the way he liked what it was doing for the FBI. So we had a very, very good relationship.
Would you say that in the years that show was on, which was basically from 1965 to 1964, that you probably had a good hand in FBI recruiting?
Well, it was one of those situations where we probably helped the FBI quite a bit, but at the same time, the FBI helped us. So it was one hand feeding the other. I mean, we both benefited from the relationship.
As I mentioned, I was a big, big fan of the FBI. I was a little on the young side when 77 Sunset Strip came out, although I did see some of it in reruns later on. But seeing you on the FBI, the one thing about Inspector Louis Erskine, the best thing I can say is he was not a partier.
Oh, no.
He was a very serious guy.
Well, you know, one of the challenges that I really enjoyed about that show, if I had been a producer, for example, and someone had come to me and said, I have a great idea for a series, the only thing is the leading characters can't smoke, they can't put their hands in their pockets, they can't have anything to do with women, they can't drink, they have to be polite. I'd say, great idea, take it to somebody down the hall, will you? I mean, it had all the ingredients to make it a stiff bore. And the challenge for me was to have it not be that, and it was I loved that challenge. I loved having to work within those very narrow confines and still try to make something interesting of the character, something universal that wouldn't bore people.
Former OSS officer Stu Bailey on the television series 77 Sunset Strip. How did you get that role?
Well, I was under contract at Warner's.
Mm-hmm.
And I had done six movies for them, and they suddenly announced that they wanted me to make a TV pilot. And I said, no, not me. I don't want to. I'd come to Hollywood, and not even knowing that they had TV at Warner Brothers. Well, they showed me a clause in my contract that said I had to do it if they wanted me to. So I made the pilot, and it didn't sell. It was turned down by ABC. I was delighted. But they tell you, well, we're going to make another one. So they made the other one, and that one did sell. And so that's how 77 began. And I have no complaints, but I didn't particularly want to do it. I had just finished a movie that I absolutely loved with a director I loved and a cast. And I the thought of going into a TV series at that point was just something I just didn't want to do. But as life turns out, TV was very good to me, and I the fact that most of my life was spent on the small screen is fine with me. I have no complaints.
How do you feel generally about the old studio system?
Oh, I loved it. I thought it was the greatest thing for actors that there could be. We weren't paid very much, but we were used. The studio, used you in all kinds of things. A lot of things you hated and a lot of things that you loved. But they kept you busy. You worked and worked and worked. And that's really what was wonderful. And there was like a protection of your life. And they publicized you, and they were back of you with their publicity campaigns and so forth. And they built up stars. And I think it was a marvelous system. But it was for its day. I mean, today it's entirely different. Probably wouldn't work today at all.
I know that your new book, My Dinner of Herbs, talks about many things, including growing up in into a legendary musical family.
Yes. Well, it's a book of stories. Some people have a peculiar affinity for having funny things happen to them or bizarre things happen to them throughout life. My father was one of those people. I mean, he had ridiculous, absurd, preposterous things happening to him all his life, and he told about them. He was a marvelous storyteller, and had a great sense of humor. And for some reason, I inherited some of that because I had my share of things, and these stories my children grew up hearing and so forth. And it was Stephanie who said to me some years ago, she said, you should really write about these things. And I thought, well, yeah, someday I'll be the only... I prided myself on being the only actor in Hollywood who never wrote a book. And I really had no desire to, because to me, the idea of saying, writing a book about first I did this and then I did that had no interest for me at all. I don't care about it, and I don't think the audience cares about it. But the stories were something else. And she really got on me and wouldn't let go. And that's really how this book came out, because she sat down and interviewed me and took all these stories down, and then she transcribed them in horrible English into a book. And I was enjoying life too much. I didn't want to spend the time writing a book. So she finally said she talked about getting somebody to write it. And at that point, I woke up and I said, wait a minute. Now, wait a minute. If anybody's going to write these stories, I'd sure like to do it myself.
So would you say the book is roughly, was basically anecdotal to things that happened?
It's largely anecdotal. It's somewhat historical, but I would say it's more about other people than about me. And it's only about me insofar as it shows things that make a good story. If there are a whole bunch of things in my life that don't appear in the book at all, because there wasn't a story there. So I only wrote what I thought would be interesting to a reading audience to learn about or to laugh about or to maybe sob a little bit about, but to enjoy in a quiet and sort of amusing way. That's about all it is. It's not an attempt to foist my life on other people or to tell them about my theatrical achievements and so forth. That's to me boring beyond belief.
I haven't had the opportunity to read the book yet, since it's just coming out, but it sounds, the way you describe it, somewhat like a book that I had read several years ago, which got quite a lot of coverage and renown, and that is David Niven's The Moon is a Balloon.
Well, I'm a huge fan of David Niven as a writer.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think people, he was underestimated enormously. He wasn't an actor who wrote, he was a writer. I mean, those Bring On Your Empty Horses and Moon's a Balloon were superb books, I think.
Absolutely.
And if my book were on the same shelf as his, I'd feel just honored beyond belief.
So you got into acting for all the wrong reasons, but you soon realized that it is a job. There is a lot of work. There's a lot of negative sides to it. There's a lot of pitfalls to it.
Right.
So what was it like when your daughter said, "Dad, I'm going to be an actress"?
I said, there's one thing you have to learn, and that is rejection. If you can put up with that, if you can stand it, because you're going to live a life of rejection. People are going to reject you until the day you die. There's no star in Hollywood that hasn't faced that. And if you're willing to do that, then go ahead. So she came out to California. She'd been to the Juilliard in New York, studied acting. And she was depressed when she got to California. She was very, very unhappy. And I didn't, you know, there's not an awful lot that a parent can do, but I called my agent. It was a wonderful woman who had done a lot with me. And I said, Ina, her name was Ina Bernstein, I said, would you as a favor to me see my daughter Stephanie? She said, sure, babe, send her over. So Stephanie went to see her. And Ina called me, and she said, I want to get one thing clear with you. I saw Stephanie as a favor to you. From now on, what happens between Stephanie and me has nothing to do with you at all. And she took her on and just did wonderful things with her. Gave wonderful properties that she put her in for movies of the week and terrific things.
You must have been very proud when she got her own television series, and it was a success on NBC, and that series being Remington Steele.
Oh, I was enormously proud. And appearing on her show was the greatest thrill I had in Hollywood. I never had anything that gave me as much pleasure as playing on Remington Steele.
How have the fans treated you over the years, especially considering most of the roles you've played have been very stand-up kind of guys?
Well, the fans have been wonderful with me. I still are. I'm so grateful to them for their kindness and their support and their interest, and it's what you hope when you play whether it's a series or a movie or whatever it is, you hope that it's giving people something that may enrich their lives a little bit, and when you learn that it has, it's very, very gratifying. I feel that that's the most gratifying thing about my work. It's not my own advancement or fame or anything like that. It's the fact that some little person who maybe had a tough fight with his mother or his wife or whoever it is, tuned in and for an hour sat back and relaxed and felt a little better about life at the end of it. I mean, that to me is the ultimate of what my profession can do.
That was part of an interview with Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. Ephraim died on May 3rd, 2014 at the age of 95. You can hear the full hour-long interview with Ephraim on my website at thestufffile.com. Click on Celebrity Audio Files and you'll find the chat with Ephraim and also interviews with others. They're all listed in alphabetical order, and you can play them right off the page.
I'm Bob Derigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. A football fan who sued the Buffalo Bills for sending him 3 too many text messages has just forced the team into a $3 million legal settlement. Here's the story. In September of 2012, a Florida man went to the Bills' website and signed up to receive news about the team through text messages to his phone. The team said it would send up to 5 messages per week, but after the man received 6 messages one week and 7 another, he filed a class action lawsuit against the team. Let's be fair. If anyone should be penalized for piling on, it's this so-called fan. Sure, text messages can sometimes cost the person who gets them, but suing over this was absurd. None of the news reports about this lawsuit included a single mention of the man ever trying to resolve this issue out of court. And that type of sue first, ask questions later mentality ends up costing all of us in the long run, even if we're never sued. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
Hi, this is Wynonna Judd, and you probably don't think of me as a person with an eating disorder, but here's my truth. Eating disorders are real, and they are not just about losing weight. Eating disorders are the way you feel about your body and the way you treat yourself. For years, I have been a compulsive overeater, and it wasn't until its effects threatened my health, my family, and my career that I finally reached out for help. Recovering from an eating disorder is possible, and I'm living proof. But you have to take the first step, so I urge you to visit nationaleatingdisorders.org.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Melman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And yes, Stuart is indeed here to talk about movies, but actually to talk about books about movies. Oh, it's also confusing. Hi, Stuart.
Hi, Peter, but let me start with this. You heard of this quote? Made it, Ma. Top of the world.
White heat.
Yeah, James Cagney. But that sort of lends to the theme of the book I'm reviewing on this week's edition of Book Banter, actually. It deals with moms, and particularly moms in the movies.
Okay.
Because throughout the history of motion pictures, moms and mother figures have played some of the most memorable characters on the silver screen. This matronly cast of characters include the always self-sacrificing Stella Dallas, the manipulative Mrs. Bates, both dead or alive in Psycho, the woeful yet strong Maude Jode in The Grapes of Wrath, the fanatically demonic Margaret White in Carrie, and Mrs. Miniver, whose steely brand of bravery during the worst of the Battle of Britain was living embodiment of keep calm and carry on. Now, Time Magazine movie critic Richard Corliss and the excellent cable movie channel Turner Classic Movies, or better known as TCM, have joined forces to produce a fine tribute to cinema's best-known moms in the book Mom in the Movies. Now, combining Corliss's knack for a clear insight and TCM's vast cinematic knowledge, the book salutes for over a century, movie mothers played a key role in plot and character development in some of the silver screen's greatest classics, not to mention offered a reflection of the many facets of motherhood, whether it be good or bad, uplifting or tragic, nurturing or destructive. Now, the book starts with a sort of Hall of Fame salute to some of the best-known movie moms from Hollywood's golden age, whether it be Beulah Bondi, who also played the mother on It's a Wonderful Life, Anne Revere, who won an Oscar for playing Elizabeth Taylor's mom in National Velvet, or Myrna Loy and Irene Dunne, who we couldn't forget, and I Remember Mama. Now, from there, the book examines the movie mother according to character type or movie genre. You get the silent era moms, martyr moms from the early days of the sound era, great American moms, eccentric aunts. They do play a role in that, too. Think of Auntie Mame, actually. Destructively manipulative moms, crime moms, and even actresses who built second careers portraying on-screen moms. Like, for example, Sally Field in Forrest Gump or Shirley MacLaine in Terms of Endearment. Now, so if you're a mom and you enjoy watching classic movie moms and mother figures like Maria von Trapp, Anna Leonowitz, Teresa Paletti, Mildred Pierce, Auntie Em, or even Medea, Mom in the Movies is an informative and entertaining guide to the women who commanded the screen as loving, inspirational figures, guiding role models, and even examples on how not to be a mother.
But are there any more wire hangers?
Well, there are actually, because Joan Crawford and Mommy Dearest are mentioned in this book.
Excellent. And did this book, I know Mother's Day just passed, did this book come out in just in time for Mother's Day? Was that the promotional push here on this one?
Oh, it certainly was. TCM was promoting this book as a great Mother's Day gift for the movie buff in your mom, if your mom is a movie buff. So yes, there was a lot of tie-ins to Mother's Day for this book. But don't let just because the day is over, it doesn't mean you can't enjoy this book year-round.
Absolutely. And the book again is called?
Mom in the Movies by Richard Corliss and the good people at Turner Classic Movies. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and it's $40.
And do you have any other ideas of similar books like this one, or maybe books that deal with dads? I mean, you can't leave dads out or whatever.
Well, yeah, well, maybe not till next month, actually.
Okay.
But go read some memoirs by some famous Hollywood moms. Like, there's Florence Henderson's written a memoir, Debbie Reynolds, Shirley Jones. There's an excellent biography of Barbara Stanwyck. There's a massive biography, but it's volume one that covers the years 1907 to 1940, so there's going to be a volume two eventually. And, of course, I do recommend Mommy Dearest. That was the book that started this whole, tell-all genre of, kids talking about their famous or infamous Hollywood parents. It's even when I first read it, when it came out in paperback in 1979, I didn't expect, serious Hollywood biography, but it was really quite the riveting, sensationalist read.
Okay. So again, this week's book is?
Called Mom of the Movies by Richard Corliss and Turner Classic Movies, published by Simon & Schuster, and it's $40.
And if people want to find you, Stuart Dearest, how can they go about doing so?
Well, make sure you bring some wooden hangers if you want to read me in the Montreal Times every week in print. Or without wooden hangers or wire hangers online at www.mtltimes.ca.
Thank you very much, Stuart.
And remember, no wire hangers.
Absolutely.
Ever.
Stuart Nolman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about a racetrack for this edition of the Stuff File program. We do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way in just a matter of moments, but I've got a few more Stuff File news stories to share with you right here, right now, on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. And, we've often mentioned Stitcher Smart Radio on the program and the fact that you can hear our show that way. And going back to when we first started working with the fine folks at Stitcher, I would often mention the amount of shows you can hear on Stitcher. And back when we first started, we'd say, there's well over 5,000 shows on Stitcher Smart Radio. And then it became 10,000 shows. And then it became 15,000 shows. Well, now there's well over 20,000 shows on Stitcher Smart Radio. It's growing by leaps and bounds each and every day. And you can listen to us on your iPhone, Android phone, Kindle Fire, and any other device you have with Stitcher. Stitcher is smart radio for your phone, so you can find it in your app store or at Stitcher.com. There's also a link on the Stuff File page at thestufffile.com. And of course, I mentioned you can use it on the go because it is radio on the go, but you can also listen to it on your desktop too if you want to be tethered to the base unit. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Now, getting back to the stuff, a woman in Brentwood, Pennsylvania reported her 4-year-old daughter missing on Tuesday afternoon and prompted a heavy police response, but the girl was at preschool the whole time. Apparently, the mother's having some issues, and she had her days confused, according to Chief Robert Butelli of the Brentwood Police Department. Sergeant Matthew DeLallo said there were probably at least 50 people, including officers from several police departments, along with the state police and the Pittsburgh Homicide Department, and search dogs who were scouring the area for the child. The mother forgot that she drove the child to daycare, signed her in, and dropped her off, according to Sergeant DeLallo. Authorities say the mother, Ashley Mulholland, admitted that she had made a mistake. "I didn't realize it was Tuesday, and I figured she was home with me, and instead she was at school, so I panicked, as any other normal parent would," she said. Well, I think we can remove the normal parent part. Well, actually, I'm getting ahead of myself. Let me just read. Except that in this case, police ended up arresting Mulholland on drug-related charges. "She definitely has narcotics, either they're prescribed to her or not, in her system from her own admission," Sergeant DeLallo said. So there you go. Now the picture becomes completely clear, right? Even though in her mind it's very hazy. I'm guessing, by the way, Child Services will now know where that kid is at all times. Meanwhile, the newest pair of Nike shoes are extremely popular. So popular, people camped out overnight outside a Brooklyn, New York Foot Locker store for a chance to buy a pair of the $250 sneakers. So, when 15-year-old Isaiah Martinez cut in line, the situation quickly went downhill. They get into a scuffle, and one of the guys in line left and told Isaiah that he was coming back with a gun, Martinez's friend, Edison Cartagena, said. He came back and just fired off four shots. The shooter, yes, the shooter, could not be found, but Martinez was hit in the foot and taken to the hospital. Looking to buy sneakers and he's hit in the foot. Oh, the irony, huh? Yeah. I don't think anyone should lose their life over a pair of sneakers, Cartagena said. Thankfully, he's okay. The whole thing is just crazy. Well, because of the incident, the store opened at 11 a.m. instead of 8 a.m. as scheduled. The shoes were sold out by 6 p.m. Okay, a couple of things here. A couple of points I want to touch on. If you're concerned about people cutting into line, wouldn't you lose your place if you left to get a gun? And besides, since you're not hanging around after firing off four shots, you've just lost your chance to buy the shoes anyway. But here's what's crazier, or actually, it's an either-or situation as to which is crazier. Someone was shot over shoes, or that enough people still came after the shooting to run through the store's entire inventory. That's what I want to know. If I was silly enough to stand in line for hours waiting for shoes, and somebody said, oh, you know, there was a shooting here like a half an hour ago, I'm thinking, that's it. I'm done going home. But that's just me. Anyway, we have two items about ice cream as the weather warms up. Story number one, in April, Häagen-Dazs announced it will introduce two new ice creams, thankfully only in Japan, by the way, a carrot orange with bits of pulp and peel, and tomato cherry made from tomato paste. Ooh, neither one of them sounds too delightful. And story number two, a South Wales ice cream maker called Lick Me, I'm Delicious, I couldn't make up that name if I tried, announced in April that it has perfected an ice cream containing about 25 milligrams of Viagra per scoop, though it is not generally available yet. You know, I'll just state it officially for the record. I like vanilla ice cream and only vanilla ice cream. I don't need my ice cream to get overly creative with items like pulp, peels, or Viagra. But again, that's just me. Anyway, we're now just about out of racetrack for this edition of the Stuff File program. We have time for one more item, and you know what that is, boys and girls? Yes, it's time once again for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
The bins are meant for safely getting rid of old prescriptions, but Edmond police said Richard Andrus, his daughter Holly Andrus, and her fiancé Matthew Waller stole what others had discarded. Now, security footage showed the suspects reaching into the bin numerous times, sometimes all the way up to their shoulders, and pulling out pills while the records clerk helped other people. The whole thing was caught on camera, and it happened inside the Edmond police station involving the Oklahoma Bureau of Narcotics Prescription Disposal Bin, said Jenny Monroe of the Edmond police. It takes a lot of guts to come into the lobby of a police department and think you're going to get away with stealing narcotics. What the trio did not know was there are monitors behind the clerk, and a jailer was watching the whole time. You can see officers come out to handcuff the suspects, and they said Holly Andrus did not think she had done anything wrong. At some point, she's reading the box, and she told her officers after she was under arrest that it doesn't say anywhere in the fine print that you can't take drugs out of the box, said Monroe. Really? Really? What kind of people walk into a busy police station to steal discarded prescription drugs? Oh, I'll tell you what kind of people. Idiots!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0247. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com. And once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0247. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Today's broadcast could be heard directly in your home, car, or wireless device, or on your computer, so you can listen on an outpatient basis. For those of you hearing this show directly inside your head, please adjust your medication.